This has been an exclusive presentation of the Project Entertainment Network.
In a world where podcasts lurk around every corner.
Listen, we just have to give the people what they want. Get it together.
Authors Tim Meyer and Chad Scanlon invite you to an hour of sophisticated conversation.
I just want to rip your head off for even saying that.
Dude, I am just saying what you're thinking.
From movies and TV to special guests, you name it, they've got it.
I'd rather gouge my eyes out than watch that movie ever again.
That's one of the finest movies of our generation.
How are you both married?
Join them every Wednesday exclusively from the Project Entertainment Network.
Hey everybody, welcome to another episode of Monster Attack, the podcast dedicated to old monster movies. Well, we've got one for you this week that has been requested by several of our listeners, and I'm glad we're finally able to get it on the schedule. It's a cult film from 1964, and it's one of the more requested films that we've gotten since we started Monster Attack. For a lot of us that grew up in the 60s, this was sort of a popular film. So I hope that the podcast will live up to the expectations of those of you that have asked for it. Like I said, it's a cult classic. I won't call it a great film, but it's one that's it's an awful lot of fun to watch. And it's called The Horror of Party Beach. And it was produced and directed by a guy by the name of Del Tenney. Now, Del, at the time, was in his early 30s when he directed this film. And he has an interesting background. He started out as a kid acting in Los Angeles. He actually did some background work and extra work in films like The Wild One and some other big Hollywood films. Went to college in Los Angeles and then decided, after being involved with theater out there in Los Angeles, decided he wanted to come to the East Coast, and he ended up coming to the East Coast. Now, actually, he's a Midwesterner by birth. He was born in Iowa, and then his family ended up moving to California, and that's where he got into acting and all of that. But he comes to New York to find fame and fortune, and he ended up living in Stamford, Connecticut, which is about an hour's drive out of New York City. And it was here that he got involved with the film industry. Now, when you look at his resume, there's not a lot of films on there, but he is known as a sort of a cult icon among those of us who grew up during this time period. And again, this one came out in 1964. If you grew up during that time period, one of the most popular genres of films was beach films. You know, you had the classic Annette Funicello and Tommy Kirk and Frankie Avalon and all those guys. Well, Del decided when he was going to write this film that he wanted to come up with something that was a spoof. Now, a lot of people don't realize when they may watch this for the first time that it was a spoof. Unfortunately, the comedy in this is, for the most part, unintentional. Okay, we'll put it that way. I'm going to be sort of loving to this film, even though by Del Tenney's own admission, it's a bad movie. He gets a kick out of the fact that it has been so popular over the years. But he wanted to take a spoof of beach party films, which were very prevalent in the early 60s, you know, and they all had that same stock formula: good-looking guy, good-looking girl, a little bit of drama, and a lot of excuses for a singing group to sing a whole lot of songs during the film. And, of course, also an excuse to put a lot of very pretty women in bikinis, and then for the gals to put guys who were built very well, you know, in swimming trunks. And you know, it was really softcore cheesecake, basically. And as kids, we loved this stuff. We did. The music was usually, pop music of the day, very popular stuff. And just to give some of our younger listeners a little bit of insight into how things were during this time period with these kind of beach movies, it was interesting. You had a series of music groups that came out during this time period, which were known as one-hit wonders. They were guys and sometimes gals that had groups that were only known for one big song. And that was it. They would hit it big, hit the charts pretty heavy, and then you never hear from them again. There's a great movie by Tom Hanks that came out in the early 2000s. It may have been 1999, right around in there. And it was called That Thing You Do. And it's a really loving look at what it was like to be a part of one of these one-hit wonders. It really gives you a good idea of how it was. I remember growing up, there was and you've heard me talk about this TV show quite a bit. In Syracuse, New York, there was a horror TV show that came on every afternoon with a horror host by the name of Baron Damon. Those of you from upstate New York will know who I'm talking about. I think and played by a guy by the name of Mike Price, who was the weatherman for Channel 9, WNYS, up there in Syracuse. These shows were really, really popular. And just before the Baron Damon show, I'm going way around in circles on this, was a little music show. And it was sort of a takeoff on American Bandstand. It was a local edition of it. And this was something that you saw quite a bit on local television stations. The show that came on, I can't even remember the name of it now, that came on before the Baron Damon show, was featuring the day that I was on the Baron Damon show as a Cub Scout. Me and my Cub Scout pack were all, we were guests on the show. It featured a group called Freddie and the Dreamers. And they had one hit song called I'm Telling You Now and a dance called The Dreamer. And that was the one thing this is one thing I wanted to mention about how music groups, and especially these one-hit wonders, were back then. And that is, if you had a hit song, it usually was about a dance, an original dance that you came up with. We were all excited because we got a chance to see Freddie and the Dreamers before we got to meet Baron Damon. So the reason I bring all this up is you've got a group called the Del-Airs that are featured here in Horror of Party Beach. Every time you've got a beach sequence, these guys are playing at a little cotillion that's right down there at the beach. And this was very, very popular on big lakes and resorts and things of that nature. And the Del-Airs were made up of about five guys. They all contributed a song to the movie, one that was called the Zombie Stomp. That was the original dance that they were going to showcase in this movie. And a lot of folks who remember this film from their childhood remember the Zombie Stomp. It was a crazy dance, and I can't even describe it. If you haven't seen the movie in a while, you're going to have to watch the movie, and you'll find out what the Zombie Stomp is. But it was pretty nutso. The song actually did pretty well. And again, that's the way it was. Every month or so, or every couple of months, you'd get one of these groups that would have a hot song and stay on the charts for about 8 or 9 weeks, and then it would just disappear. So that's what we see in the beginning of this movie. I'm getting a little ahead of the game, because just as this movie opens up, actually what we've got is an introduction to a motorcycle gang that's following our leads. So we're going to keep you right there in suspense if you haven't seen this movie. And I do urge you to find a copy of this movie and watch it, because it is an awful lot of fun. We've got our leads in this movie, Hank and Elaine. Now, Hank is, and I want to say that all of these people were supposed to be about college age. But Hank, he's already graduated from college, and he is working as a scientific assistant to Dr. Gavin, who is a leading researcher here in this little town, which is actually Stamford, Connecticut. It's never identified, but that's where Del Tenney shot all of his films. And Hank, so we got to figure, was about maybe 22, 23 years old, just as a guess. But most of the other people, most of the kids that you see in this movie are going to be, I would say, college age. Not high school, but college age. So we don't have a situation where you've got, college-age people or 30-year-olds trying to pretend that they were in high school. So you got Hank and then Elaine Gavin. Yes, the name is the same as the scientist, because Elaine is Dr. Gavin's daughter. Now, usually about this time of the show, I go into all of the people that acted in this movie, and I'm going to just make a blanket statement out here that you're not going to recognize anybody in this movie, because for the most part, Hank, who is played by John Scott, he is your romantic, you know, heartthrob and the big male lead in this. All I can say is he looks like a James Franciscus clone from this time period. He really is. He could be his brother. Good looking guy. Seems to be a fairly decent actor. And I'm going to get into that in just a few minutes when we talk about how this film was made. Played by a guy named John Scott. John Scott, all I could find on him was this film and another film that Del Tenney produced and directed as well, that was known as The Curse of the Living Corpse. And that has a lot to do with this film, because The Curse of the Living Corpse, which he shot just before he did this one, he shot because of a buddy of his by the name of Alan Iselin, wanted to do a drive-in picture. And Alan's father and mother owned several drive-ins on the East Coast. So they had the connection where they could, you know, they could get distribution. So Alan put up half the money, and Del Tenney put up half the money, and they made this film called The Curse of the Living Corpse. Well, 20th Century Fox got a look at it, and they loved it. And needless to say, there is one guy in that movie, and we're going to have to do that movie. I think we're going to have to put that on the list. That features a young Roy Scheider. Yes, that Roy Scheider of Jaws fame was in that. Well, 20th Century Fox approached Alan and Del and said, hey, could you make us a companion piece to this corpse movie, because we love this and we'd like to run it on a double bill at drive-ins and some of the B picture sites that we have around the country. So Del and his wife sat down and they wrote the screenplay for Horror of Party Beach. So that gives you some quick history into how this film got made. And that brings us to the female lead in the film. Now, this is a real interesting gal by the name of Alice Lyon. Now, I have Googled this gal, you know, other than just the film sites that I look at to see if I can find out anything about her. And there's nothing out there about her except that she was in this movie playing Elaine Gavin. That's all we know about Alice Lyon, except for one thing. This is how she got into the movie, without any acting experience at all. She's a very, very pretty gal. That helped her out quite a bit. In fact, when I watched this movie a couple of weeks ago for the first time in many, many years, I couldn't help but think, she looks like a young Joan Van Ark. She really does. She has that look about her and that kind of presence on screen about her. You've got John Scott and Alice Lyon, so you've got James Franciscus and a young Joan Van Ark. So I could see how Del Tenney would say, yeah, these guys would work really well together. They look really good together. But Alice Lyon, other than being the college roommate of Del Tenney's wife, has no acting experience whatsoever. And that might explain one particular peculiarity about this film, and that is all of Alice Lyon's lines were dubbed. They were all dubbed by someone else. We don't know who they are because whoever was uncredited. Now, sometimes in the rundown, you know, like an IMDb or one of these places where they give you a cast list, you'll see, you know, the uncredited people listed, and they might put in their voice for Elaine, but that wasn't listed, and I can't find any source that would tell me who did the voice. It could be a local actress that Del Tenney got from the Stamford, Connecticut area, because he grabbed a lot of people from that area, a lot of theater people, and a lot of the residents who play extras in this film. In fact, all of the beach scenes that you see in this film are all people who live in Stamford, Connecticut. And the motorcycle gang that I'm going to get back to here in a minute was also an actual motorcycle gang from a nearby town. So he uses a lot of real people, you know, real people, non-actor type peoples, in this film. And it sort of gives it a little, well, I should say, it sort of makes it seem like a low-budget film. But Alice Lyon, yeah, we can't figure out, you know, anything about her. I'm trying to imagine how bad was she that they felt like they had to redub all of her lines. You know, I watched the second, just a few hours ago, I watched this film again, getting ready for the podcast. I wanted to look very closely at her performance, and I couldn't really see anything that would tip off why they redid her lines, except that maybe they couldn't hear her. It may have been that she delivered them so weakly that, because her facial expressions are okay. She's not over the top too badly, but the gal who dubs her plays it over the top quite a bit. So I don't know. This is going to be the mystery of Horror Party Beach. Any of you guys out there know the answer to that? Shoot me a line, because it's got me a little mystified as to why they felt like she's the only one in this whole film that has her lines dubbed. Now, the one thing about this film that really sort of telegraphs that it's a low budget film is that all of the outdoor scenes and virtually all of the shots, except for the ones that are done on a sound stage, are dubbed over. And this is something that is not an unusual practice in movies, but it really stands out here. If it stands out, then it gets to be a little bit of a problem with me, right? I mean, it just sort of gets a little irritating, because you've got a sound guy who builds a sound design around these scenes, so he has to not only resync up all of the audio. You bring the actors back into a sound studio, and they watch the movie and they're redoing their lines, and then the editors have to sync it up. And then they've got to put in all of the sound effects, and all of the background noises. Now, one thing I did know about this film from reading about it was that just about all of the sound effects that you will hear in this movie basically come off a sound effects record. And it's really obvious. All of the cars sound the same. The one most irritating thing about this movie, I didn't notice it much as a kid when I saw this, but definitely as an adult watching this movie, was that the police car, every time you see a police car in this movie and it's moving, they always have the siren going. Always. Even when the cop car is just stopping by at someone's house to give them a message, they've got the siren going the whole time and the lights. It's almost like they thought, we better put that in there or people might not realize it's a police car. It's crazy. That's one little thing. And again, I'm going to have some fun with this movie because there's some nutty things that they do in here. Other people that are in this movie, you'll never recognize, because virtually to a person, all of the people that appear in this movie are pretty much known for Horror Party Beach. Now, you've got a gal by the name of Marilyn Clark, who's in a couple of sort of racy, exploitive-type films. She plays a gal named Tina. Guess what? She's the party girl. She's sort of the bad girl, the stereotypical bad girl in this film. And then you've got Eulabelle Moore, and she plays the black housekeeper. And I'll tell you what, folks. Again, I had to put the big 64 filter on this one because, it was like the worst exploitive, racial type thing you see in movies during this time period. And she was, your stereotypical black maid who believed in voodoo and thought all of these murders from these monsters was voodoo. And it would never fly nowadays. Even in a spoof, I don't know if it would fly. But everybody else, you're not going to recognize too much. I do want to mention one other guy by the name of August Mayer plays a character by the name of Mike, who is the head of the biker gang. Now, let's talk about them since we left off talking about them. We've got an opening shot in this movie where Hank and Tina, apparently Hank and Tina are dating at this time, but things are not going well because Tina has got a little bit of a problem with booze and likes to party. She's the loose girl of the group. A lot of the guys like her because, she's free and easy. How she gets with Hank, we don't know. It's like the most unlikely couple in the world because Hank is straight as an arrow. He's graduated from college. He's working for a scientist. He's very intelligent. And then he's got the party girl. So we're not, maybe it's opposites attract. But we've got them driving down the road in a really cool little car from that time period, an MG. MG convertible, really a cool car. In fact, it reminded me a lot of the car that Clark Kent drove in The Adventures of Superman. It's just a sharp little car. And I'm sure that's one reason it got put into this movie. Because, people are looking at what? They're looking at girls. They're looking at guys. The girls are looking at the guys. And the guys are looking at cars. And they really, they like, they're going to like a character that's driving a cool car. That makes them cool in their book. They drive to the beach where the Del Airs are playing. All the kids are dancing on the beach. But on their way to the beach, they encounter this motorcycle gang led by Mike. And they get into a little bit of a race. because, you know, they say, hey, this guy's got this fancy car. Let's race him a little bit. And of course, the MG wins. Now, one thing that really happened when this film was being shot was that the actual motorcycle gang, one of the members thought, hey, they want me to race? I'm going to race. And as he took off, and this isn't in the movie, but as he took off to try to win the race, he gets into a wreck and ends up wiping out a couple of the other guys and causing serious injury to Mike, the guy played by August Mayer, and that delayed shooting the rest of this film for a couple of weeks while August recovered from the injuries from that wreck. In fact, the authorities in Stamford, Connecticut told Del Tenney, I don't know if we want you to shoot here anymore if this kind of thing going on. But they did, and he ended up shooting about 3 weeks at a beach nearby, West Beach, near Stamford, Connecticut. They're all dancing, they're singing, and that sort of thing as the Del Airs are really cranking it up. That's it, you know, and I got to admit, these guys were pretty good. For 1964, they were a pretty good little rock and roll band. And, of course, this leads to, and I'm going to skip over the storyline, a lot of this, and just hit the highlights. Mike and Hank get into a big fight because Tina is coming on to Mike because Hank is sort of ignoring her while he's talking to Elaine, who, again, is the daughter of the man he works for. And Tina's feeling a little left out. And all of a sudden, you know, Hank gets jealous and he and Mike go at it. And the one thing I just want to mention about the fight, because it goes on for a couple of minutes, Hank ends up winning and Mike comes up and you think, oh, you know, and I'm used to watching movies nowadays. Oh, man, he's just going to clock him out of nowhere. And he shakes his hand like, good fight. You bested me. Yeah. You know, and it's like, yeah, okay, maybe that's the way it worked in 1964 or in an episode of Happy Days, but that's not the way it really works. So Hank is still talking to Elaine, and Tina's really upset. So she goes moping off and swims out to this little rocky island just off of the coast there. You know, and really within an easy swim. And she's out there sunbathing and hoping someone will pay attention to her. And unfortunately, somebody does. Now, between the beach sequence and the motorcycle race, we've got a quick sequence that shows a fishing boat going out into the middle of the ocean and dumping these big barrels of radioactive waste. We know they're radioactive waste because they got the danger radiation symbol on them. And one pops open at the bottom of the ocean and starts leaking out. And we see that there's some bodies down there. Actually, they're more like skeletons. And it's like, you know, and it takes, you know, we don't know at first what this is all about. But as this liquid hits them, or hits this one, this big skeleton, it starts forming like skin or something. And this is the creation of the monsters. Now, the special effects in this are a lot of fun. Because the way Del Tenney formed the monster was he took a stage, an actual stage, and shot this through a large aquarium that had about 3 goldfish in it. It almost works, except the goldfish just go back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. So it's very obvious he's shooting it through a fish tank. But the guy, you know, they got, you see these things form and all of a sudden you see the creatures. Now, if you saw the picture that I used to promote that we are doing Horror Party Beach, that's the creature. They're pretty crazy looking. Tenney was able to get on the budget he had 2 of them made, 2 full heads. So in scenes where there's supposed to be multiples of this creature, they're in the background, except for the 2 guys that have the head, because they don't want it to be obvious that these guys don't have a head on. So anyway, the other thing that was sort of weird about this costume was it was very hard for the people in the costume to see where they were going. So they stumble around a lot. But let's go back to Tina, who is our first victim in the film, and as while she's out there hoping someone will pay her attention, oh yeah, she gets some attention from one of the sea creatures who climbs up and works his way over to her. And of course, she's totally oblivious. This thing should have been obvious as anything, attacks her and covers her in chocolate syrup. Now, most of you that know about films know that black and white films made during this time period use chocolate syrup for blood because it looks sort of like blood in black and white. And if you used anything red, it wouldn't look right. It would look gray and it wouldn't look like blood. So, I mean, there are some sequences in here like this one that were actually cut from some of the prints that went over to the UK because they thought they were too violent. So they actually had to cut some of this. But you know, for 1964, it's a little grotesque. And Tina is later found, her body's later found washed up on the beach, and everybody panics because they don't know what's going on. So here you've got this dead girl. Nobody saw anything. Nobody, and the authorities figure, well, the only thing that makes sense is she had to have been attacked by someone that came out of the ocean. So that is our first victim. Now we've got a funeral for Tina. And of course, you know, this is where we really meet Elaine. And Elaine throughout this whole movie is just sort of moping around the whole time because Tina was her friend, even though she was a little jealous about her and Hank, because Elaine obviously wants Hank. And, you know, and we know that they're going to get together. I mean, that's very obvious in these kind of films. But she's been invited to a pajama party. Yeah, again, a pajama party for college-age kids. And, you know, she said, no, I'm not going to go. And this is leads us to probably one of, I think, the best scenes in this whole movie, the pajama party. Because the girls think that the guys from a nearby fraternity are going to show up like they do. It's like, this pajama party is like an annual event, the way they talk about it, and the guys always show up. So they've left them a trap with a bucket of water over the door to try to get them to come in, and somebody shows up. But one of the girls says, yeah, it smells like dead fish. Are they going to throw dead fish at us again? Like they did that last year. And it's the creatures. Now, the reason I said this is one of the better scenes in the film, because this is a pretty intense scene. And you've got about like 20 girls packed in this family-type rec room, two doors in, and both of them are being invaded by these creatures. They have nowhere to go, and all of these girls get killed, except two of them do get hauled off by the creatures. Now, one of the weird things about the story of this is we don't know what happens to them. The creatures take them off and take them back into the water, but we never do learn what happened to them. But all of the other girls in this party are killed. I'll tell you, it reminds me of a scene that we would see about 8 years from now, in 1972, in Return of Count Yorga. Now, you know, a lot of film historians say, well, that was influenced by the Sharon Tate murders, and it could have been, you know, because those took place in 1968. But I have to wonder if maybe the filmmakers were a little influenced by this scene, too. The guy would have been a kid at the time this came out, and I think this might have influenced him a little bit. I would hazard a guess that this film has influenced other similar scenes, may you know, that involved these monsters crashing into a house and no escape. Because it really is a pretty good, it's one of the most effective scenes in the whole film. The rest of them leave a lot to be desired. So we've got now the police are stumped because you've got now several killings and we don't know what's causing them. But they're sort of zeroing in on the fact that maybe it is something that's coming out of the ocean. The press has caught on that it's monsters. And so it's like monsters attack and all that stuff. And, you know, this is a little bit of a, you know, pointed, you know, look at, you know, how quickly the press back then would jump all over a story about this and conjecture. But still, the scientists aren't really sure what's causing this. Well, they're about to find out pretty soon because we have a couple more deaths. We've got three women that are from New York City heading back to New York City. And, you know, they come on to the gas station guy to get some directions for New York City. And they're talking about, man, this is where all those murders take place. Let's get out of here as fast as we can. So, you know, they're getting set up. Now, you know, these characters are going to get it. They're going to get nailed. And they do. And I just want to, I mention that scene only because the gas station attendant and the guy they're flirting with is Del Tenney. He makes a cameo in the film. These girls are supposed to go right. They don't. They go left. So they end up near the old quarry, a little closer than the guy who gave them directions told them to go. They're out almost in the middle of the woods. They have a flat tire. And while they're changing the flat tire, and of course it gets to be night, the creatures attack and the three girls are dead. So now we have three more people that are dead. And now they're getting very, very concerned that something is going on. Of course, Eula Bell is saying, I think it's voodoo. That's why she's convinced. She's got voodoo dolls that she's playing with, hoping to help. You know, somebody's got to do something here. Now we've got a couple other incidents that set up, you know, the storylines here. We've got two girls that were at a beach cotillion that Hank and Elaine happened to attend because Hank was trying to get Elaine out of her funk, let her have a little fun. And these two girls are supposed to get picked up by one of the girls' brothers. And just as one of the creatures, played by Del Tenney, by the way, comes after him, The brother pulls up just in time. They get in the car and take off, not realizing how close to death they came. Well, this leads up to another scene where what we'll call it the creature goes shopping scene, which really does this creature and all of these creatures in, because as he's walking down the center of town, streets are deserted because people are afraid to go out because of these creatures, except for the ones that go out partying. You know, they're out all over the place in full force. He sees these mannequins in the window, these mannequins of the women, and he thinks, hey, I need some blood, because that's what these guys drink. They drink blood. And he smashes the plate glass window, trying to get to this mannequin, and in doing so, cuts off one of his hands, claws, whatever you want to call it. I know, it's pretty goofy sounding, but just play with me on this a little bit. It's a lot of fun. That leaves this hand or claw or whatever you want to call it lying on the sidewalk, which, of course, is found by the authorities the next day. And now Dr. Gavin has something to work with, and he determines that these creatures are protozoa, or sorry, some kind of, you know, a creature that has been created, and they automatically assume that, yeah, you know, that's where that fishing boat went down. So there were people down there. There were bodies down there. These corpses got taken over by this radioactive waste, and they turned into these things, these living protozoa. So how do we kill them? You can't kill them by bullets. You can't kill them by, you know, knives or anything. But, you know, so we got to figure out how to kill these things. Meantime, you've got two guys who are partying at a cocktail lounge. This is almost stereotypical stuff. And they get killed as well. So be that as it may, as everybody's trying to figure out about these creatures, Gavin discovers through an accident that Eulabelle causes that these creatures can be destroyed by sodium. I don't know why they couldn't just use table salt, but I'll go into this in a minute. They got to find sodium. Seems like to me salt would work because that's basically sodium and chloride. But you know, anyway, they need sodium. They got a little bit at the lab, so they're going to try to track down where these creatures are coming from. They got several bodies of water that they got to check because they realize these creatures are radioactive. So anywhere they go, they're going to leave a radioactive signature. Now, one thing about this movie that really wasn't picked up too much by the people who watched it the first time when it came out in 1964 was this was sort of an anti-radiation atomic warfare type movie as well. That message is not handled too well by Del Tenney in this. So that's the only reason you've got radiation figuring into this. They're going to try to track these guys down. They're getting some Geiger counters coming up from New York. And they're going to get a crew of teams of authorities, you know, led by the cops to go out and test the water. One thing that struck me is, and I guess because it was a low budget, you would think the federal government would get involved with this and send some people up to investigate it, but they don't. They leave it all to the cops. Even though you got 30 some people that have been, well, close to 30 people killed during these incidents. Nope, they're going to leave it to the local police department. Okay, I know. That's one of the little things I like to make fun of in this movie. It's one of the things that makes it so much fun. So they've got everybody out there looking at every body of water in the area. And then, you know, Hank comes up with the idea and says, hey, you know what? What if there's a lot of these things? We don't have enough sodium to kill them all. I better find some sodium. And the only sodium that's available is in New York City. Well, I got to tell you, folks, Hank drives to New York City. And even though this is only 1964, he must have gotten to New York City on like early Sunday morning around 6 o'clock because there's nobody there. But he gets the sodium. I mean, it's just amazing. You know, it's like there's no traffic. It's incredible. I figure they had to have shot this, you know, right at sunrise, you know, on a Sunday or something when there would be no traffic. That's just a little observation. But Hank gets the sodium while they're out there looking for where these things are from. Now, they've got cops checking every lake, every river, you know, every anything that has a coast or whatever, every pond. But guess what? We mentioned an old quarry earlier, and that's where the three gals were killed that were trying to find a way to New York. And of course, now it's an old quarry, but it turned into a big lake, as a lot of old quarries do. And guess who gets to check the water at the old quarry? Well, it ends up being, do I have any guesses here? Any of you that haven't seen this movie, can you figure this one out? Of course, it's Elaine. She ends up going there all by herself. Yes, because you got to have some drama as we build up to the big climax. And Elaine discovers, oh my God, Their water's radioactive, and then she sees some bubbles, and something's coming up out of the water. She screams, and I won't say runs off, because she's got to try to mount this incline, and she's having trouble, I guess, getting back to her car, because she ends up working herself down the coastline of the of this quarry while these things are sort of chasing her, and she trips and falls. And I won't say she doesn't break her ankle, but it's all covered in blood and sort of pinned while these things are coming after her. Well, her father has found out that she's going out to the old quarry. He has Ulibel call the cops and get a message to Hank that they need to come out to the quarry. And then he takes off to get her and gets there just in time. I guess he sees where her car's parked, and it gets to her just as these things are attacking. So he's got a little bit of sodium he can throw at the thing, and when it hits him, they just sort of go up in a puff of smoke and flames. And now the others are coming after him. Of course, he's fighting, and one of these creatures is trying to kill him, and Hank gets there just in the nick of time with the cops with a big bucket of sodium, and they end up killing all these things and, of course, saving Elaine and saving Dr. Gavin, who we found out got a little burned, the whole thing, but he does survive, and Elaine survives, and everybody lives happily ever after. Yeah. I'll tell you what, folks, the one thing that I've mentioned from time to time when it comes to bad movies is the worst thing a bad movie can do is be boring. And if they're boring, then they're absolutely worthless to me. I won't even watch them hardly. This is one of those so good it's bad films. And I put it right, and I'll tell you what, folks, most of you know I'm a huge fan of Ed Wood films, and I put this right up there with Ed Wood movies. Del Tenney tries very, very hard, and he has a lot of fun. And yes, I think you can tell that this was sort of tongue firmly in cheek from some of the crazy little scenes that are in there that are definitely geared towards a teenage crowd who would be into beach movies and cheap monster movies. But I got to tell you what, folks, Del Tenney has been criticized over the years for making films like this, like Curse of the Living Corpse and also Horror of Party Beach. This film, when it was released by 20th Century Fox, blew those executives away because they put it out in several drive-ins. They ordered 700 copies of the film to be distributed because they were so stunned at how well their screenings went. And this film returned to Del Tenney himself $1 million. That means more than likely that Alan Eiselin also got $1 million as well. And there's no telling. I can't find the figures as to what the total gross was for Horror Party Beach, but it did very well for a little, you know, a little movie that was shot for about $50,000 or $60,000. And, you know, which is pretty, it's a bad movie. Even Del Tenney said it's a bad movie. But as he told people, I laugh all the way to the bank. And he's lovingly referred to in Stamford, Connecticut, as that town's Ed Wood. Now, Del Tenney died about 6 years ago, and that's what the mayor said at his eulogy. He said, "We have our own Ed Wood here in Stamford, Connecticut, and his name is Del Tenney." Again, this is a lot of fun, and I know a lot of you guys out there listening really, really enjoy this film, and I get a kick out of it. It was fun watching it for two more times just within the last month here. It's a very entertaining film. It was very lovingly spoofed by Mystery Science Theater 3000, and it has developed an incredible cult status over these last 55 years. So check it out. If you haven't seen it, I know everybody's heard of it, The Horror of Party Beach, and I think you'll have a really good time watching it. Hey, folks, we'll be back with you again next Monday with another very special monster movie out of my little ditty sack of memories as we present another new episode of Monster Attack. And again, folks, thanks for your support, your suggestions. We're getting down to some of the ones now that were recommended to us a few weeks ago. So a lot of you guys were very patient on this one. I was sort of saving it for a special occasion. I thought, nope, I can't wait any longer. We got some others that people have recommended to us, and sometimes we'd be lost without those recommendations. So we appreciate it. You can always drop me a line at the Facebook fan page, which is Monster Attack Reviews at facebook.com/Monster Attack Reviews. And we do answer all of our email, and usually we can get all of the films you've requested on board as well. We've got one that I've held for a couple of years now, and I apologize to the guy who recommended it to me, and I am going to do it in the next couple of weeks. And if he's listening, he knows the one I'm talking about. So folks, have a great week. We'll see you next Monday on Monster Attack.
Armcast, Dead Sexy Podcasts. I'm your host, Armand Rosamilia. Fridays exclusively on Project Entertainment Network, where I interview authors, publishers, editors, artists, filmmakers, narrators, the lady from Walmart, whoever I feel like talking to. That's every Friday, Armcast, right here on Project Entertainment Network.
This has been an exclusive presentation of the Project Entertainment Network.